genocide, mass dispossession, extermination. These terms are used to describe what was done to Native peoples in the U.S. My guest today believes another set of atrocities, much less well-known, must be added to the list, that of grave robbing, the raiding of Native American grave sites from which Native body parts and artifacts were taken away, traded, and collected in huge numbers. These desecrations occurred over the course of almost 200 years, and they took place, writes Tony Platt, in the full light of day, with the support and encouragement of leading citizens and government officials, as well as some of this nation's most distinguished academics. Museums competed to out-collect one another. Scientists sought crania as part of an effort, in many cases, to prove theories rooted in racism. Boy Scouts and amateur archaeologists participated in what became a popular pastime. Anthropologists, including a number of prominent ones at UC Berkeley, recruited people to find burial grounds and instructed them on what to dig up and send back. Virtually no one except Native communities thought twice about this widely endorsed practice of grave looting. Tony Platt has written a book, an expose called Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. The book's primary but not exclusive focus is Humboldt County in northwestern California, where Tony bought a vacation cabin in 1978 in a place called Big Lagoon. Grave Matters lays out both the sordid history of the plundering of grave sites, as well as the organized efforts beginning in the 1960s to stop the excavation and repatriate body parts and artifacts. Tony Platt is a visiting professor in the Department of Justice Studies at San Jose State University. I recorded a two-part interview with Tony about his book in our KPFA Berkeley studios. Today, we present part one about what was done to and with Native burial grounds and remains and grave goods until the 1960s. I asked Tony Platt how Humboldt County, California is described in tourist guides and travel literature.
Humboldt County is the quintessential northwestern California tourist spot. It's described as the Redwood Coast. It's described as a contemporary wilderness. It's described as unspoiled, a place to go and be close to nature, a place to get away from the metropolis, to get away from the city, to be in a place that's sparsely populated, and to be at one with the surroundings.
And the people now known as Yurok, they lived in very large numbers in Humboldt County. Tell us about them, how they lived, how long they've been around.
Well, the Yurok and many other groups in the Northwest have lived for 10, 15,000, possibly longer inland. At the coast, we don't exactly know, but I think 5 to 10,000 years is not an unreasonable history. And they are, the Yurok and other groups that lived in this area were relatively peaceful because there was tremendous resources in the environment. The Yurok, for example, in Humboldt and Big Lagoon, where I write about, had access to incredible amounts of food and water. The redwood forests were nearby to make homes and to make boats. They had so much of their basic needs met in a regular way that they could then have all kinds of ceremonies and create all kinds of communal and spiritual activities as part of their daily life and practice. There was some warfare, there was some problems and conflicts with different groups in the area, but relatively speaking, compared to a lot of other places, this was quite peaceful. They had a pretty productive and easy life. The evidence is that they lived long lives and that they were, for the most part, untroubled by their contact with outside forces because the Northwest was not really exploited in a systematic way until the Gold Rush. So even though they had contact with, for example, Russians and English missions coming through and the Spanish, this happened relatively rarely. They were, for the most part, peaceful relationships with these groups that came through, and then they moved on. And the Gold Rush, as it happened in the late 1840s and 1850s, transformed that whole relationship.
Yeah, we are going to talk about that. Tell us about the Yurok settlements that existed, that used to exist in Big Lagoon, a place dear to your heart, a place that you've been going to for over 30 years?
Yeah, Big Lagoon is one of three major lagoons. It's above Trinidad. For those of you that know the area, you go through Eureka, you go through Arcata, and then you go through what is now a small town called Trinidad. Used to be a whaling place and also used to be a major Yurok center. And then you come to the first of many lagoons, and Big Lagoon is the largest of the lagoon. It's an ecological marvel because it abuts the Pacific Ocean. It's surrounded by forests, and at one time very dense forests. And it's a place that the Yurok settled because of its access to all kinds of resources, because you could get to places from it, and because you could see the world around you very easily. And they might have had as many as 8 or 9 settlements around this large lagoon at the coast.
All right, so the gold rush happens, of course, in the mid-1800s. So what happened to the Yurok, and specifically to the Yurok in and near Big Lagoon, as a result of the gold rush?
Well, the gold rush was a period of shock and awe for people that lived there. It came so quickly, so suddenly. It came with thousands and thousands of people. It came with people with superior technology and military might, and it literally overran the area. The people on the coast and people who were on important supply lines and trails were killed, were removed, were dispossessed. I do think that this was a genocide that took place throughout the Northwest. It was sanctioned by the state. There were organized militias that went around and massacred people, over 50 such massacres in Humboldt. People were removed from lands that they'd lived on for generations and generations. The term the Yurok and other groups use is from time immemorial. These were places that had been settled for a long time and therefore had village sites, had burial grounds, had ceremonies associated with them. And even though people survived and fought back and there was guerrilla warfare throughout the Northwest and places like Big Lagoon and Humboldt, there was all kinds of fighting that went on. For the most part, this was an unequal battle and people were removed from these places.
Did anything survive as far as the settlements you just mentioned in and around Big Lagoon, the Yurok settlements?
There were some settlements that survived, and there were some people that survived. Even in the hardest of times throughout the Northwest and in places like Big Lagoon, Yurok and other native peoples hung on. There were many women that stayed. Either they had consensual relationships with pioneers and the lumbermen and the gold hunters that came in, or they were sold to men, or they were abused by men and made into prostitutes. So many women, Yurok women, stayed. Some of the men became guides on the trails and worked with the pioneer groups as they came through. So there were survivors, and they did stay around. But the village settlements themselves were eventually destroyed because Big Lagoon became a place for farmers and traders and other people to come through, and they basically tried to erase all the settlements that had existed there.
When did you first learn about the digging up and the looting of Yurok graves in past decades and past centuries?
Well, I'm a historian and a historian concerned about public history, so I know quite a bit about the history of California. But I must say, like many people that leave the Bay Area and go up the coast to get away from the city, that I too turned a blind eye to what was the more sorrowful history of this area. So for many years, I didn't know about the graves and how the graves of people there had been dug up. I lived there and spent much time there on the coast since the mid-1970s. And in about 1999, I finally read a technical report on the area, and in that report there was a brief paragraph that said that a meadow in Big Lagoon, a meadow that I walk by all the time when I'm up there, had been a major Yurok settlement, and that in the mid-20th century, people had dug up that settlement area and taken away not just the artifacts from the graves, but also the human remains. So that was a shock to me, and I began around this period of time to become personally more interested in rituals of death and mourning, because my son had died in 2006. And as a result of that and the fact that he requested to have a burial at Big Lagoon, I began to study more the Yurok ceremonies of mourning and their rituals and so on. And that got me more preoccupied and interested in that history. So those two things, one a very personal experience, and then this experience of reading in this report about this tragedy of the past being compounded by the digging up of the remains of Native people, made me curious about what had happened and compelled me to do something about it.
Tony Platt is my guest. He's a visiting professor in justice studies at San Jose State University, and he's author of Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. Well, what this book does is kind of lay out the results of your very intensive research into what happened with the excavation of Native remains and Native artifacts. So maybe we could start this way. When did the collecting of remains and artifacts begin, and for what reason?
Well, the collecting of artifacts and remains can really go back to the 18th century. A good starting point might be the 1780s, when Thomas Jefferson in Virginia dug up a barrow, which was a big burial ground, and dug up about 1,000 Native remains, skeletons, because he was scientifically curious about learning from those skeletons and trying to figure out where the human species had come from. So from 1780 to about 1960, a period of about 180 years, 1960 you get the Native American movements, the American Indian movement being one of the more militant ones, but many of the movements of the 1960s and 1970s draw attention to the desecration of graves and try to put a stop to it. So for 180 years you have widespread digging up of graves going on throughout the nation. It's been estimated that maybe 1 million graves were dug up in this period of time, which I don't think is an exaggeration. I know of one man in Humboldt County alone who, by his own account, dug up 600 graves. And the first reason for doing this, the primary reason for doing this, was to collect artifacts, because in many places where people were not cremated but were buried in graves, they were buried also with important artifacts, in the same way that people all over the world often locate and put in their graves of their loved ones things that are important to them. So collectors knew that by going into the grave sites, they would be able to find things that had ceremonial value. And beginning also in the late 18th century, you have this frenzy of collecting going on of Native artifacts. You have military expeditions coming from Europe. The Spanish and the British had expeditions, and on those military expeditions, they had people collecting literally crates and crates of artifacts that were taken back for personal collections, for public collections, and eventually placed in these large-scale museums where they become massive collections that people come to view in the 18th and 19th century. That frenzy was also followed in the United States. The American museums got going for the most part a little after the European museums, but they too get into this hunt for collecting Native artifacts. So there's a worldwide competitive collecting going on where museums and collectors are trying to outdo each other, trying to get more and more artifacts in the same way that collectors do this today, whether they're collecting stamps or old money or bottles or anything, that people can become very furiously competitive around wanting to have the biggest and best collections.
And in the case of museums and, say, academic institutions, was it the case that they would send out their own staff to excavate these areas and take what they wanted, or would they engage local people to do the digging up?
Well, it varies. Early on in the 18th century, they're trading with people and they're buying stuff and collecting stuff and getting pointed to graves by local contacts and so on. But throughout the 19th century, there begins to be the development of this whole complicated trade in artifacts that involves large-scale institutions like museums and universities and philanthropists like George High on the East Coast and the Hearst family out here and the Huntington family and so on, who are engaged in large-scale operations. But they also then begin to develop relationships with local folks throughout the 19th and early 20th century who see themselves as archaeologists and collectors and sort of amateur anthropologists. And they're the ones that are scouting out the area, pointing the anthropologists and the collectors to where the grave sites are and where they can find things. And because particularly on the West Coast and the Northwest Coast, where people have been defeated and removed from their community settlements, it's easy to find these village places, easy to find these grave sites, and they become easy pickings for the collectors.
Why were scientists so interested in the remains of Native Americans, what did they think the analysis of such corpses and crania could do to their endeavors?
Well, throughout the 19th century, if you remember, there's a whole scientific interest in the origin of the species. And scientists everywhere are looking at human remains and trying to analyze them and trying to understand where did we as a human race come from, how do we differ from other species, what are the differences that exist between different populations. And so beginning in the early 19th century, when there's a tremendous emphasis on collecting native human remains, scientists think that, first of all, that they're going to find out the answer to the origins of the human species, because they think, for racist reasons, that native people have never changed or shifted over time. They're sort of fixed in the Stone Age. And therefore, if you can look at the corpses of native people, you'll have some insight into what it was like long, long ago. So that's one scientific reason for it. And the second scientific reason is throughout the 19th and well into the 20th century, there is a eugenic preoccupation with trying to understand racial difference. And this is based on the notion that, in fact, we're not from one human race, which we now, for a long time now, have known that, but they were from multiple human races. And in particular, there were a lot of people trying to understand and to provide so-called scientific information about what made white people and Europeans more civilized and more advanced than other groups. So here in California, particularly at the University of California at Berkeley, there's a preoccupation with trying to measure the skulls and the brains and the insides of human beings to understand what makes them racially different. And in the case of native people, they were trying to prove that native people were racially inferior.
You said up to possibly a million native skeletons were excavated and brought to museums or collected by people. What can you tell us about the size of some of these collections, both of native remains and of artifacts, by, say, the second half of the 19th century?
Well, with respect to artifacts, you're talking about millions and millions that end up in museums. I've visited museums in Spain and England and Germany and seen artifacts that came from the Northwest Coast. This huge trade and collecting ended up with literally millions being sold and traded. Now, the native people weren't altogether victimized by this trade. There were some native people that were able to hold their own and get a decent price for artifacts that they were actually selling. For example, the Pomo up the coast near Ukiah were able to get relatively decent prices for their baskets that they were making. But many other people on the Northwest Coast, and particularly places like Humboldt, were defeated. And like any defeated people at the end of a war, they're desperate to survive. They've been displaced from the place where they live and their access to food and resources. And so even when they're selling things very cheaply, as well, of course, as having things stolen from them and things taken out of their graves. So in terms of artifacts, we're talking about millions. In terms of human remains, we don't know the exact number, but the estimates go from 500,000 to 1,000,000. Again, I don't think 1,000,000 is an exaggeration. And we know that Berkeley, for example, by 1948, according to their own accounts, had collected 10,000 native human remains. And aside from the racist assumptions about the research that went on at Berkeley and other places, I think what adds to the horror of all of this is that, for the most part, I would say maybe 90% of human remains were never even studied. They were just boxed and broken up into different body parts and put into basements and put into cellars, and scientists never even got access to them. So aside from the racism of the science, you also have the horror of the fact that they weren't even used for scientific purposes.
I'm reading from Tony Platt's book, Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. Digging became an end in itself, a pastime and preoccupation for everybody from Boy Scouts to country doctors, men's clubs, philanthropic ladies, wealthy collectors, and amateur archaeologists. All those kinds of groups, and obviously not all of those groups, but those kinds of groups were actively involved in openly collecting this material?
Yes, this was not something done secretly in the middle of the night. People weren't embarrassed about doing this. People were proud of doing it. People did it openly. People did it with the support of political and legal institutions. I went through thousands of documents of different accounts of people doing this, and I never found any account where somebody said, should we be doing this? Is it okay to be doing this without permission? Is this disrespectful? Is this an imposition of power relationships on a defeated people? There was no sense of reflection in people's accounts. And I think local people who did this also felt that they had a right to do it, because they were doing it with legal and political support of higher and more powerful institutions. And I think this, to me, brings to mind the studies that have been done, for example, of the history of genocide in Europe and the history of Nazism, where we used to think in the past that it was a small group of different kinds of Nazis, different kinds of human beings that imposed their will on the population. But in fact, from recent studies, we now know that genocide is a popular project, that it requires a huge amount of participation, that it requires all kinds of formal and civil institutions to participate in what goes on. And I think when we look at the history of genocide and dispossession and then grave looting in California, we look at a project that lasted a long period of time and in which the most powerful and respectable institutions participated.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. On our website, againstthegrain.org, we have a link to the book Grave Matters, which is authored by my guest Tony Platt, P-L-A-T-T. He is a professor emeritus of social work at California State University, Sacramento, and he's author of a number of other books, including Bloodlines, Recovering Hitler's Nuremberg Laws from Patton's Trophy to Public Memorial. Well, UC Berkeley keeps coming up in this book, Grave Matters, and we need to talk about at least one person who, it turns out, was the first faculty member at the anthropology department at UC Berkeley, a guy named Alfred Kroeber. He was also the director of the Museum of Anthropology at Berkeley for many years. Who was he? How did he get interested in collecting native artifacts and remains?
Alfred Kroeber is one of the significant anthropologists of the 20th century. He's not only important in California, but he's known throughout the country and he's known worldwide. He got his PhD in anthropology, one of the first people to do that, with Boas, the important anthropologist on the East Coast at Columbia University. And he and a handful of other anthropologists helped to really create cultural anthropology in the United States and to make Berkeley into one of the four or five top anthropological centers in this country. He surrounded himself with a rather remarkable group of young people who, like himself, created this field of anthropology, built the department, built the collections, built the museum, created relationships with groups and organizations all over the state, and did this with extraordinary energy and resourcefulness, backed by the Hearst family in terms of their financial support.
And how experienced and savvy and aggressive a dealer in native remains and items did Kroeber become?
Well, Kroeber was an extraordinarily complicated and contradictory person, as we all are. On the one hand, he had great appreciation for native cultures. He developed very close relationships with elders who became his informants and confidants here on the Northwest Coast. He wrote many things that were extraordinarily appreciative of native culture and was able to reconstruct ceremonies and practices that then have enabled many tribes today to go back and use those materials and use those documents to continue their ceremonies. And he also believed in building cooperative relationships with some of his informants who he brought to Berkeley, who met other people, who talked to students and so on. On the other hand, he was part of a growth industry in anthropology that required him and other department figures and leaders to collect artifacts, to collect resources, to collect people, to build the museum, to build the resources. And in many ways, there was like a division of labor between different anthropology departments around the country. And Kroeber staked out the West Coast, particularly California, and told other anthropologists to stay away. And even though he himself was not particularly interested in digging up graves and analyzing human remains, it was under his leadership that the department did go about very aggressively and very ambitiously getting people to send human remains to Berkeley, sending out expeditions to collect human remains and artifacts, and who presided over the growth of one of the largest collections of human remains in the country.
And how interested was he and his colleagues in Humboldt County and what could be found there?
Kroeber had a very close, very personal relationship with the Yurok. When he wrote his magisterial work on the Indians of California in the 1920s, he devoted more chapters to the Yurok than anybody else. He had a cabin, a home up on the northwest coast, very close to actually where my cabin is, where he went up there and visited the local Yurok and developed friendships there. So yes, the Yurok and Humboldt County and Big Lagoon and that area was a region that was very close to his heart as well as to his research.
And when you write in your book that the excavation of native grave sites in the 19th century was not the monopoly of racist scientists or museums eager to display freaks and oddities, and I understand that Kroeber comes a bit later, but are you pointing then to many people's perhaps genuine interest in studying the Native American and understanding them and not necessarily using the analysis of remains and Native items and grave goods to present some kind of a racist agenda or, again, to display a kind of freak show?
Yeah, I think this is a complicated issue, though. I think there were anti-racists who were interested in collecting human remains because they wanted to prove that, in fact, Native human remains were just like any other human remains and that we were part of one human race. But I'd say that was a minority of scientists and anthropologists who were doing that. And even though Kroeber himself was sympathetic to that because he didn't believe in biologically racialized differences, he also supported the department and promoted a man named Edward Gifford, who was the primary person interested in studying human remains. And Edward Gifford was very much in the mainstream of California and American eugenics. He believed in racial superiority and inferiority. He wanted to measure the cranium and study brains and study the internal workings of the human body as a way to try to prove racial difference. So I'd say that Kroeber, in terms of his practice as the leader of the department, presided over a department that promoted highly racialized and, in many ways, racist views of human difference.
What about a guy named Alex Herdlicka? He was an anthropologist at the National Museum in Washington, D.C. in the early 20th century. Tell us about this guy and what he hoped and did, in fact, amass.
Herdlicka was a scientific racist at the national level. He was very, very interested in the human body and thought that by studying the cranium and the human body that he would be able to develop a scientific understanding of racial hierarchies between different so-called civilizations. And he was very influential because he wrote a pamphlet in the early 1900s, and the pamphlet went out far and wide around the United States. And the pamphlet basically encouraged people, first of all, to go out and find grave sites of Native people and to dig them up, and then how to preserve corpses if they were still fresh, how to pack them up, and how to send them to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. And he amassed a huge amount of human remains, and out of that came a large body of work that provided ammunition for people who believed in a racial hierarchy of human beings.
Do we know the amounts of remains the Smithsonian managed to collect?
Well, we're talking about tens of thousands of human remains.
And, you know, I want to kind of move beyond the general descriptions here. So, for example, grave goods, artifacts that were buried with Native peoples in these burial grounds, in these cemeteries. Can you specify, can you list some specific items that one might find buried there and now perhaps displayed in museums?
Well, for example, up on the northwest coast, and particularly amongst the Yurok, though amongst other tribal groups as well. There was a ceremonial item known technically as a zoomorph. Amateur collectors often call them slave killers on the misassumption that they were used to actually kill people, which they never were. But the zoomorphs are rather wonderful, fanciful, animal-looking objects that were highly prized and that were kept only to be brought out for ceremonial activities. And there were smaller versions of them and larger versions of them. And that when people died who owned and possessed those zoomorphs, they were typically buried with them. Those artifacts were buried with them. And when people went into the graves to dig up the human remains and look for artifacts, something like that would become highly desirable. It could sell for tens of thousands of dollars. Today, there's no reputable museum that will display such a zoomorph or such an artifact like that, because museums that are ethical now take the position that they will not display for human consumption any item that came from a grave. But there are private museums for example, the Favel Museum in Klamath Falls in Oregon, which I just recently visited again, which not only displays the zoomorphs taken from the graves of Big Lagoon and other places, but also has a picture in the exhibition center of the man who actually looted the graves.
That's Tony Platt talking about his book, Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past, published by Heyday. Tony is a visiting professor in justice studies at San Jose State University. He's also taught at the University of Chicago, UC Berkeley, and California State University, Sacramento, where he is professor emeritus of social work. What you just heard is part one of an interview I recorded with Tony Platt. We plan to broadcast part two of the interview, which addresses efforts beginning in the 60s and 70s to stop the excavations of native grave sites and to have the remains and artifacts repatriated to tribes and native communities. We move now to part two of the interview. Here I asked Tony what priority Native American activists in the 1960s and 70s assigned to stopping the excavations and repatriating Native remains and artifacts.
This issue was very, very important in the Native American movement. It had been for a long time. There's a tendency in California to think of Native people here on the Northwest Coast as being passive, almost being complicit in attempts to destroy them. There's been a real failure to understand historically the history of resistance and opposition. So if you go back into the 19th century, early 20th century, throughout the 20th century, you see persistent efforts by Native groups to stop the looting of graves and the looting of artifacts. But it's not until the 1960s, until there is a nationally organized, though decentralized, movement by Native Americans to take on a variety of issues having to do with land and sovereignty in particular, that this issue comes to the forefront. And if you go back and read the manifestos and the demands and issues that are put out by Native groups in different parts of the country, the issue of repatriating human remains and artifacts is very high up on the list of demands.
And if we go to Humboldt County, which is kind of a wonderful, in your book, it serves as sort of a wonderful microcosm for many of the issues and struggles you recount in this book. If we go to Humboldt County, one key actor in that county and in the state of California was the Northwest Indian Cemetery Protection Association. What triggered the founding of this group in 1970?
NICPA, as it was known, came together through people from different tribal groups. It wasn't just Yurok, it was Hooper and Wiyot and people from different tribal origins who came together and particularly were incensed by the persistent looting of their grave sites throughout Humboldt County and other counties on the Northwest. This was a group of leadership men and women who had a considerable amount of political experience and cultural experience in their communities, who came together and formed what I think was the first such organization in the country to make as a priority the repatriation of artifacts and human remains and to stop the looting of grave sites. Well, the triggering incident for this was that a group of anthropologists and students came up from the Bay Area, led by people from San Francisco State, and that they thought they were going to go in and excavate, and from their own viewpoint, they thought they were going to protect grave sites that had been opened up already. And Stone Lagoon turned out to be a place where important Yurok people had been buried and that Yurok family members were still living there. And when they came in to start their excavation, they were confronted by the local Yurok and forced to stop the dig. And it was that confrontation and that antagonism that happened on the coast there over that particular dig that then led to the formation of this organization that for the next several years carried on political and legal and community struggles around this issue.
Give us some more examples of the militancy of this organization.
Oh, this was an organization that would challenge anthropologists and students who came to community places where there were grave sites, that would stop them digging, that would confront them with the racist history of the past, that would lecture them on genocide, that would make sure that they didn't come back to do digs unless there were people there to give them permission and to monitor it. It was a very, very difficult situation for anthropologists and archaeologists who'd basically got away with this for decades to now be confronted by native groups. But this was the 60s and 70s, and the same kinds of changes that were going on throughout the university and other departments was also going on in anthropology departments. So you got the rise of a new group of socially responsible anthropologists, young people, people like myself who were in a different department at the time but were activists in other parts of the university, who began to call for in anthropology what they called a socially responsible anthropology. And that meant that they would not do any digging or any excavations unless it was approved by native groups that were involved with the region. The project would have to be collaborative. It would have to be led by native people on the sites. And that totally changed the practices of anthropology and archaeology over the next 25 years.
And yet one could understand a very deep suspicion that native communities would have developed over many years and decades toward anthropologists and archaeologists.
I think suspicion is putting it mildly. You're talking about long-standing hostility, antagonism. When you go back and read the history of what anthropology and archaeology has done in this region, and also the history of what journalists and writers have written about people, and understand the deep-seated racism that underlies a lot of the practices and ideas, then it becomes clear why people would have that kind of suspicion and that kind of resistance. I'd say that distrust is still very close to the surface, particularly in a place like California, and that it still will take a long time before we have a more collaborative kind of relationship.
And to get back to the militancy of the Native American movement, that sometimes bled into or turned into satire. Tell us what the American Indian Student Organization at the University of Minnesota did in 1970.
Well, organizations like that is Native Americans who were on campuses, also began to write proposals and write grants in which they proposed that they would go into, for example, pioneer cemeteries and dig up the white folks that were buried there and study them. And some of these groups also did actions where they went into local cemeteries where dignitaries were buried and began the process of trying to dig them up and brought the media and politicians there so that they could understand the double standard that was operated here. So this was a very diverse and very creative movement that used all kinds of legal, political, and cultural strategies to draw attention to this.
Margaret Mead shows up in your book. What did she have to say at a 1970 symposium entitled Anthropology and the American Indian, which was part of the annual meeting of the American Anthropological Association?
Well, I think for people like Mead and many other established anthropologists in the early 1970s, they would go to conferences and they were used to giving papers and talking and being respected. But then they would find that they would be confronted by this new breed of socially responsible anthropologists and also by native groups that would go to anthropology conferences and confront the established anthropologists. And most of them then reacted in very defensive ways. Margaret Mead famously at that conference said, you know, we're always very respectful, we always work together, we're always cooperative. But she was challenged and she did change as a result of that and began to work with different groups and began to understand that things had changed. But for many anthropologists and archaeologists of the old generation, this was a very difficult transformation to go through, and many stuck in their heels and fought against Native American groups that wanted to stop archaeology in its tracks.
You write that by the time of the founding of the Northwest Indian Cemetery Protection Association in 1970, that the political climate had changed, both on the local and state levels. Could you elaborate?
Well, this movement nationwide, this Native American movement in all its varieties, it wasn't a concerted, coherent movement with a national agenda. It was made up of many, many different organizations throughout the country. But the issue, this issue of repatriation of artifacts and human remains, was at the top of the agenda of movements in many different parts of the country. Beginning in the 1970s, you see a board of supervisors such as the one in Humboldt that begins to listen to these organizations, begins to take seriously the demand of stopping the excavation of graves without permission, begin to get their local sheriffs and police departments to start enforcing the law against grave robbery. And that happens all over the country. And there is a turn in policing activity. There's a turn in legal activity. And over a 20-year period between really 1970 and 1990 until the federal legislation is passed in 1990, you get a proliferation of local and state ordinances that put severe penalties on looting of graves and try to put a stop to that practice.
What's the most important federal legislation?
The most important legislation is NAGPRA, Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act, passed by Congress with the support of the White House in 1990. To Native Americans, this is really the equivalent of the Civil Rights Act for African Americans, a profoundly important act where the federal government steps in and not only puts a stop to the looting of grave goods, but also puts a stop legally to the trading in grave goods and human remains, and also creates a legal bureaucratic process by which tribal organizations around the country can petition to have the human remains and artifacts returned to them. This is an extraordinarily important piece of legislation that's still in operation and still has many problems. But before we talk about the problems, it's important to understand its significance legally and politically to begin with.
So under this law, and I think also the National Museum of the American Indian Act, at least some museums need to inventory the remains they have, the grave goods and other artifacts that they have, as a first step toward repatriating some of these items. Can you talk about how successful this has been, whether museums have followed the instructions and mandates as far as inventorying, and what has happened as far as actual repatriation to Native tribes and Native organizations?
Initially, there's been quite a bit of success. I mean, any institution that at any time received federal money that has any kind of collection that might have come from a grave or might have been a ceremonial artifact from a tribe is responsible under NAGPRA of 1990 to go through its inventory and make lists of everything that they had, and that those lists would then be published, and tribes would then be able to look at those lists and make a claim to get them back, so-called repatriation. This was a huge operation for museums and universities all over the country. Many of them didn't actually even know what they had exactly, so they had to hire huge staffs and go through their materials and process them and write them up and publicize them. So that's happened systematically throughout the country, and I would say that any institution that has taken federal money has complied with that. They've also set up a legal process by which then people can get things back. That process has been somewhat successful initially, but is also a very cumbersome, bureaucratic legal process that still most items taken from graves, most artifacts have not been repatriated. And I would say maybe 85 to 90% of human remains also have not been repatriated. There's a great deal of frustration amongst tribes because of the slowness of this process. You have to go through a detailed application. You have to have staff who know how to do that. You have to have resources that you put into it. You then have to work with a bureaucracy and go through that bureaucratic process. Often institutions like museums and universities will resist that or go by the letter of the law, and it gets very slowed down, as it has at Berkeley. Often there's not enough information to know exactly where things came from, and so the universities and museums don't have the information to really tell people where the bodies or the artifacts came from. So I'd say it's stalled. And again, I think there's an analogy here to the civil rights legislation for African Americans, a sense that a revolutionary act was passed and something new was put into process, but there's very much an unfinished revolution. And with respect to repatriation, there's a long, long way to go and a great deal of frustration amongst tribes and also amongst groups that don't have tribal recognition because they have no rights to repatriation.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the efforts by UC Berkeley to repatriate goods and remains? And also, where does Berkeley currently store the native remains it still possesses?
Berkeley went through the process of hiring staff to document all the items that they had in their collections and to publish them. They complied with that. And Berkeley has started the process of meeting with groups and tribal organizations and tribal representatives who come through and who file a claim and go through that process. But it's important to understand the bureaucracy of this process is not limited to Berkeley. The group that really literally owns these possessions, human and artifactual possessions, is the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents is the legal owner of all these materials on all the campuses. So if a group makes a claim on Berkeley's human remains, for example, of which they still have about 10,000, and since 1990 they've returned, I think, less than 200 human remains, that claim has to go through the museum. It has to go through the Berkeley bureaucracy. It then has to go through the UC bureaucracy and be approved by the UC Board of Regents to repatriate anything. So it's a very, very slow, very frustrating, very cumbersome process. Many Native organizations in the region feel that Berkeley has deliberately stonewalled this process and not speeded it up and not taken initiative to make things go better.
And the location of the remains?
The remains are currently underneath the Hearst Gym on campus in a climate-controlled but rather dank and depressing place. They've been there for quite a while now. Before that, they were in other laboratories. They were for a while, I think, in the Campanile, another place. I came across recently a photograph from Life magazine in 1948. It was a big publicity spread for the University of California. And in that article, Berkeley proudly shows off a laboratory full of human remains and skulls being measured and looked at and prodded by researchers. And in the article, it says that Berkeley in 1948 proudly possessed 10,000 human remains. So that's 48. That's a long, long time ago, and they still have that same amount of remains.
Okay, so we have all these local, state, and federal laws. We have all these requirements that museums and collectors do certain things in relation to their collections of remains and artifacts. Does this mean that the looting of grave sites and illegal trading in Native artifacts has stopped in this country?
No, it's not stopped, but it's seriously reduced. In local places, you occasionally get somebody who's going out and trying to dig up something for his own personal advantage. They usually get caught. They get prosecuted. Compared to the institutions that were involved with this, that's really slowed down. There is still a trade in illegal goods. There have been federal cases recently against people in the Southwest trading in huge numbers of illegal artifacts. It still goes on, but compared to 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it's been dramatically changed.
Tony, you conclude this book with an argument, and that argument is for the creation of some kind of public commemoration or memorial that acknowledges what was done to hundreds of thousands of Native corpses over the long history of this nation. What do you think should be done?
There are so many things that we need to do. California in general practices a scrupulous forgetting of its tragic past. We do a very, very poor job of remembering the human-made tragedies of this state, which go back to what happened to Native communities, but also go through the long, tragic history of the 19th and 20th century, all the way up to Pelican Bay today, you know, through the rounding up of Japanese Americans during World War II, going back to the lynching of Mexicans during the Gold Rush. the ethnic cleansing of Chinese in the late 19th century. We have a long history of racial tragedy that can really hold up to many other regions around the world. And yet we do so little. We do almost nothing in our schools. We still teach our fourth graders about the mission as a place of civilization and uplift. And fourth graders typically go and visit a mission and learn how to make a mission from a sugar cubes or from a kit. There's really very little education about the mission as an institution of colonial control and the devastation it did to native communities throughout the middle and southern part of the state. We talk about in the seventh grade to school children about the Holocaust and Anne Frank in Germany, which is an important thing to do. But we don't talk about the history of genocide in California. Our school children basically get a sanitized, mythic history of California as a state of progress and development without any attention to the serious tragedies that are embedded in the landscape. We have almost no public recognition. We have almost no memorials that you can go and visit and solemnly think about what's happened in the past. There are no places comparable to the Holocaust memorials in Germany and France and other places. There's nothing comparable to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. California has an absence of public memorials, an absence of public history on these issues. So anything that we could do to begin to have a public conversation about this past, to get our children to start talking about these issues in the classroom, to reform the textbooks and get these issues into the textbooks, to build public memorials and public discussions, anything would be better than what we haven't done so far.
Tony Platt, PLATT, his most recent book is Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. Tony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we will look for you next time.